So good afternoon. Welcome to the 419th meeting of the Mid-Coast Forum on Foreign Relations, both to our members and guests who are here today and to our public radio audience reaching us through the stations of Maine Public Radio. Today's meeting comes to you from Point Lookout Conference Center in Northport, Maine, and I'm George Look, president of the Forum. The Forum was founded in 1983 to promote discussion of the development, formulation, and implementation of U.S. foreign policies. We are now in our 36th year of monthly meetings featuring prominent speakers covering all aspects of U.S. foreign policy. Details about past and upcoming forum programs are available on our website at midcoastforum.org. Today we are very pleased to have with us Dr. Stephen Platt, who will be speaking on how China's 19th century shapes its present and future. Stephen R. Platt is a historian of modern China. He is a professor at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. He received his PhD in history from Yale University in 2004, where his dissertation won the Theron Rockwell Field Prize. He is also a fellow of the National Committee on U.S.-China Relations Public Intellectuals Program. Professor Platt's newest book is Imperial Twilight. We have copies of it in the for sale out in the area where you came in. So Professor Platt's newest book is Imperial Twilight, published by Knopf in 2018. It is a history of the long-term origins of the Opium War. Imperial Twilight was a New York Times Book Review Editor's Choice and was shortlisted for the Bailey Gifford Prize. The Sunday Times and Financial Times both listed the book as one of the best history books in 2018. His previous book, Autumn in the Heavenly Kingdom, published by Knopf in 2012, was also a New York Times Book Review Editor's Choice and was a Washington Post notable book and won the 2012 Cundill History Prize. Through his teaching and writing, Professor Platt seeks to engage the wider public in deeper issues of China's history and its relation to the West. Stephen, welcome to the Mid-Coast Forum.
Thank you so much. Is the microphone working? Can you hear me? Okay. Thank you for the invitation to come here. First of all, what an incredible audience. This is amazing to see this many people in the dead of winter. I'm always happy to have a chance to come up here. My great aunt had a house at Saturday Cove, just up the road here, that she started going to in about 1915, when you had to take a steamship up from Boston. And when I was a kid, my parents bought a cottage at Bayside. So a lot of my summers when I was a kid were spent in Bayside in Belfast. I've never been here in the winter before, and what a winter it is. So the purpose of my talk today is really something of a prelude to the Camden Conference that's coming up on the theme of, will this be China's century? So I won't talk about this century. I'm going to be giving you some of the background that'll help you better understand the speakers that are going to be coming in February. In particular, I want to focus on the background of the 19th century, which is the area where I do my research. And it's an era that is absolutely central to nationalist history today. And it's central to China's conception of itself in the world, especially with regard to relations with the Western powers. It's the 19th century that sets the template going forwards. And it's also the 19th century, or at least the moment preceding it, that sets a pattern today for the role that some in China believe the country should play in the future. To start off, what was China in the 19th century? And here, when I say 19th century, I'm talking about the long 19th century, as we historians like to say, which means I can go from the 1790s up until the 1910s or so. So a little, the century plus. In the 19th century, the power in Beijing was the Qing dynasty. And importantly, the Qing dynasty rulers were not ethnically Chinese. They were not Han, they were Manchus, who had invaded from the north in 1644 and had taken over from the fallen Ming dynasty, which had been a Chinese dynasty. So keep in mind here that all the way from 1644 up until 1912, China is not ruled by Chinese people. I mean, Chinese in the sense that we say Han Chinese, which is the dominant ethnic group in China. In the language of the government today, the Manchus are, they are today a minority within China, so they are considered one of the Chinese peoples, and so they can say, well, it was always ruled by Chinese, just Manchu Chinese. In any case, when the Manchus took over in 1644, they were very small relative to the population of the Ming, maybe 200,000 Manchus, trying to conquer an empire with 150 to 200 million Chinese people. And one of the keys to how they were able to effect that transition, aside from the military power that they could project at certain points, but they could not conquer the entire breadth of the empire, the key was to preserve a lot of the culture of the Ming. They preserved the Confucian examinations that were used to choose officials. They preserved Chinese officials who had served in the Ming were welcome to continue under the Qing dynasty. They adapted themselves in many ways to the Han Chinese and their culture. The emperors of the Qing dynasty learned Chinese and how to read and write and do calligraphy. And for that reason, there's sort of a shorthand where people say, oh, China, you know, foreigners can come and conquer China, but give them a few generations and they're all going to be Chinese. And you know, they're going to be wearing Chinese clothes and eating with chopsticks. And so it goes. It's like sort of this irresistible center of gravity. This happened to an extent in sort of an external view of things, but not completely. The Manchus were deliberate in making certain shifts in China. For one thing, all Chinese men had to shave their heads and grow a long braid called the queue, which is a sign of subservience to the Manchus, and they had to wear Manchu clothing. And this was something that was heavily resisted at the time of the conquest, but by the time we get to the 19th century, it's been naturalized, and this is how the Chinese people think of their hair and their clothing. If you look only at Chinese documents and imperial records that are kept in Chinese, it seems almost as if the Manchus just assimilated to China. If you look at the documents in Manchu, which certain scholars have been doing in recent years, you find that in their own language, the Manchus were proudly superior to the Chinese and saw themselves as a very different race. In any case, through the 17th and 18th centuries, the Manchus expanded China's frontiers. They brought in Manchuria, of course, which was their own homeland in the north. They conquered Taiwan to the east. They conquered Tibet and Xinjiang in the far west, roughly doubling the territory they had inherited from the Ming dynasty. And important, the one thing that I want to underscore here is that today's map of China is essentially the map of the Qing Empire, minus Mongolia and questionable Taiwan because it's under a different government now. But the territory that today's China claims as its natural, you know, God-given territory is the territory of the Qing dynasty, which was a Manchu dynasty, which used Chinese armies and Manchu armies to conquer peoples who were not ethnically Chinese to begin with. In any case, this huge empire reached its pinnacle in the late 18th century, a time when China was viewed with absolute awe in Europe. It was seen from outside as a stunning model of unity, of rational politics. It was the great civilization of the other side of the world, as it was seen in the 18th century. French Enlightenment philosophers saw in China a civilization with no need for a church or superstition, that it was a civilization, as Voltaire saw it, founded on rational texts and ruled by scholars, and you can't get more rational than that. It was seen as impossibly unified and prosperous, and it was always just out of reach. So the Qing dynasty, as experienced by Europe, well, how did they know that it was prosperous? How did they know? It was because certain Jesuit missionaries from Europe had been able to get into China at various times, and they brought back glowing reports. But for the most part, Qing China was inaccessible to Westerners. In particular, from the 1760s onward, all Western trade with China was restricted to one single southern port, Guangzhou, known at the time as Canton. And it was to that port in South China that foreigners, especially the British, came to buy Chinese tea. And they were generally quite frustrated that they could only trade at that one port. They were always, furthermore, short of things that the Chinese wanted in return. They brought cotton and wool fabrics. They brought elaborate clocks, seal skins. They scoured the Pacific to look for products that the Chinese would buy. Otter pelts, sea cucumbers, sandalwood. all kinds of different products in order to sort of tempt the merchants of Canton and tempt the fashionable urbanites of China who would be buying these products. But ultimately, mostly what they brought was silver. And from the 1600s up into the early 19th century, China was the largest net importer of silver in the world. And it flowed into China through Canton, through the foreign trade. And it was the one thing that the merchants at Canton always seemed to want. The British, meanwhile, had an almost limitless appetite for tea. Yet the only place that they could get it in the early 19th century was in China. And the only place in China they were allowed to buy it was at Canton. Furthermore, the British government got a 100% tax on the tea of the East India Company coming back to England, so it was a major source of government revenue as well. So simultaneously, the British government came to depend heavily on the China trade, while also suffering very, very limited, limited conditions there at Canton. So what was it like for the foreigners at Canton? This is something I talk about a lot in my book, which I won't dwell on in the talk, although you can ask about it if you want. At Canton, the foreigners who traded there could not, they weren't even allowed to enter the city itself. Canton in the early 19th century was the third largest city in the world, over a million people, following only Beijing and London. Foreigners could not go into the city. They had to content themselves with a little compound outside of the city, down by the river, about 200 yards by 300 yards. Which is where they were allowed to live for part of the year. They couldn't even stay year-round for most of the time. But within the grounds of that little compound, the Chinese merchants had built them a series of 13 beautiful granite buildings in a European style. These were very comfortable, utterly luxurious for the foreigners who lived there. They're absolutely crammed with Chinese servants. All the way down to menial servants who pulled ropes to keep the ceiling fans spinning. All of this was being arranged by the Chinese merchants that they dealt with. But nonetheless, this was a gilded cage. And over the long term, they wished for greater access to other ports and expansion of their trade. But I would like to just point out that they had it pretty good nonetheless. They made quite a bit of money. It was not an expansive trade, but the full trade of Europe and America with China, which was the largest empire in existence. About a third of the world was China in the early 19th century. All of that went on in a space of just a few acres. And as some of the merchants at Canton like to point out, it was a space smaller than the footprint of one of the pyramids in Egypt. So this was a trading world in which China held all the cards, where trade took place under terms set by the Chinese government and foreigners followed along. Britain first tried to change the system in 1793 by sending its first ambassador to China, the famous Lord Macartney, a reputedly handsome man, who showed up full of charm with two ships full of 600 crates of gifts for the emperor in Beijing. The emperor at the time was Qianlong, the longest reigning emperor in China's history. Among those gifts were, you know, trading products like fabrics, but also scientific instruments, lenses, weapons, a planetarium that filled an entire room, the best, most cutting-edge scientific demonstrations they could have. They brought a hot air balloon, and a man specifically was brought along to operate that hot air balloon, along with a diving bell. And so, I mean, but they were going to, the goal of this embassy was to impress the Qianlong Emperor with the greatness of British civilization. And as the hot air balloonist, as they hoped, floated over Beijing and struck awe into the people of China who could see that the British had mastered the natural world, that surely, they hoped, this would lead to Qianlong welcoming the British with all of their trade and opening up the ports and allowing them to station an ambassador permanently at the capital, et cetera, et cetera. These were grand hopes. It took a full year for the embassy to get to Beijing. And when they got there, it turned out that Macartney, if he was going to have an audience with Qianlong, was expected to perform a ceremony called the kowtow, which is now a permanent part of the English language. It means sort of obsequious deference now, and what it specifically denoted was a ceremony which everyone who had an audience with the emperor had to perform, which is you would kneel on the ground on two knees, you bow all the way down and bang your head on the ground three times, stand up, do that again three times, stand up, do that again three times. So basically nine full kneelings down to the ground, touching the head to the ground, to acknowledge the superiority of the emperor. This wasn't just for foreigners. This was something that Chinese ministers also did when they were in an audience with the emperor. This is where things got thorny in the embassy, though, because McCartney didn't think that the British should have to do this, because as he saw it, the King of England and the Emperor of China were equals, and they should treat each other as equals. And so they negotiated over, well, what should he do? And the Chinese handler said, well, you need to do the kowtow. And he said, well, I will perform the kowtow if one of your high-ranking ministers performs a kowtow in front of King George. And he pulls out a portrait that he brought along of King George. And they said, no, I'm sorry, we can't do that. And McCartney sort of proposed to go down on one knee and kiss the emperor's hand like he would do to the King of England. And the Chinese thought this was absolutely disgusting. You did not kiss in public, let alone, I mean, you did not touch the emperor, let alone like go smearing your lips against him. In any case, the negotiations concluded. McCartney was allowed to have an audience, allegedly just going in and kneeling. He actually, it turns out, did a fake kowtow. He did nine kneelings down to the ground, but only one knee, he insisted. But in the end, the British were sent packing. They received no concessions, no opening of trade, absolutely no change to the status quo. And the Qianlong Emperor sent a famous letter to the King of England telling him that we already possess everything we need, and we have no need of your country's manufacturers. And this cut the British to the bone. I mean, this wounded their pride. It seemed that the Chinese looked down on them. All these wonderful scientific demonstrations that they brought, that they set up in a room of the palace, according to the balloonist, actually, who left a memoir, he saw the Qianlong Emperor came to take a tour of all these beautiful lenses and chandeliers and various different kinds of scientific instruments. The emperor apparently looked at them for about 2 minutes and then said, well, this seems nice enough to amuse children, and then left. In retrospect, this would be seen as a peak of sorts for the Qing dynasty. And the government today looks back nostalgically to the Qianlong era as being what China should be again. It should be central to Asia, an admired and powerful country that can exist on its own terms, and where foreigners come as supplicants to play by China's rules. However, those nostalgic views tend to paper over real problems that were cropping up in China by this time. China's population had doubled under the Qianlong Emperor in the 18th century. So there were twice as many people. From 150 to 200 million people in the Ming, it was now 300 to 400 million people at a time when the world had a billion people total. So there were enormous pressures on the land and on the cities. And as it happened, there was no way for the government to raise revenues to keep up with the expansion of the population that it was trying to govern. Furthermore, Qianlong became senile, yet held on to his position as emperor in the tail end of the 1790s, a time when, as he receded from clarity and from active government, those behind him stepped in to take up the slack. And it was a period of an incredible rise of corruption in the government bureaucracy. And by the time he died in 1799, internal rebellions were already beginning to unsettle the empire. Beginning with the end of Qianlong's reign, the 19th century is going to be a nearly constant process of decline. There are reversals at times. There are downslopes that are sharper at times. But it clearly passes its peak at around the time that McCartney was there figuring out whether he should kowtow. So I want to move forward now to the great shock, the moment when, as it is understood, when China's weakness was finally laid bare before the world, when its decline, when the weakness that lay behind that facade of power and unity became apparent. And this is the Opium War. And it's the very foundation of modern China's nationalism. The Opium War, which took place from 1840 to 1842, you can read it as a collision between a declining China and a rising Britain. You can also read it as the opening salvo in what would be really a century of exploitation and victimhood for China. So remember, how did it come about? Remember the trade deficit that the British had with China, always trying to find something that the Chinese would take in exchange for the tea that the British wanted to buy. Well, they had generally made up for that in silver. The Americans especially brought silver. In the early 19th century, about a third of Mexico's entire silver output was carried by New Englanders to China as part of America's China trade. By the 1820s, however, there was a worldwide shortage of silver, and the British could no longer get enough to buy the tea that they wanted. It was becoming more scarce. It was becoming more valuable. They had to find something to balance their trade, something the Canton merchants would buy in large quantities, and their solution wound up being opium. The poppies grew well in British India. The British East India Company could produce opium in India, have intermediaries ship it over to China, and it turned out to be the one product that the merchants of China seemed eager to buy in almost limitless quantities. It was technically illegal, but nobody was ever prosecuted for it. Government corruption meant that most officials were involved in it. Those who were supposed to be suppressing it were using it themselves, dealing it themselves, and taking bribes. And indeed, most of the users prior to the Opium War appear to have been government workers, especially underlings in the little government offices. So the opium trade expanded rapidly in the 1820s and 30s. It was an expensive luxury good, but the prices started coming down as more and more came in from India. And finally, in the late 1830s, China cracked down. The emperor cracked down on the opium trade. The reason, incidentally, was because as the opium trade rose, since it was an illegal trade, the exchange was opium for Chinese silver. And it had grown to eclipse the tea trade to the point that by the 1830s, silver was now flooding out of China through the illegal opium trade. And it was the view of the Chinese government that this was going to destroy the Chinese economy. So largely for that reason, they cracked down on opium. An official named Lin Zexu was sent to Canton to shut down the trade. He came to the compound. He put the entire place under lock and key. He pulled out all of the Chinese servants. These foreigners who had been used to living, you know, waited on hand and foot, had to cook for themselves. It was actually one of their greatest hardships. One of my American merchants who was there was sort of trying to make ham and eggs, and he said it came out kind of like the sole of a shoe. But so the foreigners in the compound were put under lock and key. Lin Zexu demanded that all the opium be handed up to be destroyed, and this would spark a war. A controversial, complicated war, but it would spark a war that Britain would win handily against China. It was a war that pitted the world's most advanced naval power, Great Britain, against a country, Qing China, that had not needed a seagoing navy in more than 100 years, and so it did not have one. The war played to Britain's advantages, and what it did when it was concluded was that it shattered the Canton system of trade. It forced open 5 ports to British trade, and then along came the French and along came the Americans to trade there as well. It established extraterritoriality for the British in China, that they could not be subjected to Chinese laws, only British ones. And at the time, I should emphasize here that it was actually a minor war for the Qing dynasty. There weren't that many battles fought. It took place just along the coast. But it was a watershed for foreign relations. And it marked a point where Western powers realized that China was no longer as powerful and unified as it had seemed in the 18th century. And furthermore, they realized that you could get what you wanted from China by force. And this is where the real 19th century gets underway. As remembered in China today, the Opium War is the beginning of what's known as the Century of Humiliation. It's a long century, which begins with the Opium War in 1840 and goes up, if you are on Chiang Kai-shek's side, it ends in 1945 with the defeat of the Japanese. If you are on Mao Zedong's side, it ends in 1949 with the founding of the People's Republic of China. But it's a period during which China suffered repeated wars with foreign powers, first European, then Japan. Forced to grant territorial concessions, continuing to pay war indemnities, bullied, exploited. This is the memory that's at the heart of nationalist history in China today. The humiliation and weakness of the 19th century, China being bullied by all comers. And starting in the 1920s, school children in China were taught over and over this phrase, never forget national humiliation. And this, and Chiang Kai-shek wrote it on every page of his diary, to never forget national humiliation. And they had to hold on to the memory of the Opium War and everything that it wrought, because this is what had to be avenged. Following the Opium War, it goes downhill, and it becomes increasingly difficult to separate domestic and foreign factors in China's decline. So the one other event that I want to introduce you to here, because it's actually far more important than the Opium War, that yet far fewer people have ever heard of it, in America at least, is the Taiping Rebellion. Actually, hands up if you have heard of the Taiping Rebellion. Oh, good. The Taiping Rebellion, which took place from 1850 to 1864, was the bloodiest civil war in modern history. 20 to 30 million Chinese were dead by the end. And the leader of the rebels was a foreign-influenced Christian who, as it happened, read pamphlets written by Western missionaries who had translated the gospel into Chinese and came out of this with an epiphany that he was the Son of God, the younger brother of Jesus Christ, and that he had been sent to China to destroy Confucianism and bring Christianity, and simultaneously to destroy the Manchus and restore the Chinese to power. They rose up in South China in the early 1850s, captured China's alternate capital of Nanjing in 1853, and dug in for a 10-year civil war that brought the dynasty to its knees. Really, the Qing dynasty probably should have ended at this point. This would have given them a revolution around the time that Japan went through its own Meiji Revolution and transformed its society. But foreigners helped out in the Taiping Rebellion. British and Americans were neutral for the first decade of the war. It was illegal for Americans or British to jump in on either side, though there is a wonderful, famous mercenary from Salem, Massachusetts, named Frederick Townsend Ward, who went over and raised an army on the imperial side with modern weapons, but he was always in danger of being arrested by the U.S. authorities. In any case, the Americans and the British maintain sort of a principled stance of neutrality. They cannot interfere in the Civil War, except that on top of the Taiping Civil War, the British and French go to war against the Qing Dynasty again for their own reasons. It's a war known as the Second Opium War. It ends in 1860 with the destruction of the Qing Emperor's palace outside of Beijing. The emperor flees into exile in Manchuria and dies there the next year without ever coming back to take his throne. So between the Second Opium War and the Taiping Rebellion, by the early 1860s, it seemed obvious to people within and outside of China that the Qing Dynasty was going to collapse, which significantly prompted a moment of anguish in Great Britain. Because as some in the British government saw it, having a sort of an outsized notion of their own influence on China, they wondered, is this whole Taiping Rebellion Britain's fault for having fought the Opium War and destabilized the government, which allowed rebels to rise up? And as those figures in government argued, if it's really Britain's fault that China is about to collapse, then it's our humanitarian duty to bring peace back to China. And so on sort of spurious humanitarian grounds, the British threw themselves onto the side of the Qing Dynasty. Their enemy from two opium wars suddenly became their ally. They lent them officers and ships and supplies and weapons, and ultimately the Taiping were suppressed. The aftermath of the Taiping Rebellion was a general agreement among foreign powers that the Qing Dynasty should stay in power. And going further through the 19th century, what you have are foreign trading powers that are acting like parasites on the dynasty. They want the Qing Dynasty to stay in power, because if it falls, they lose their treaties. And who is going to govern China? Certainly the British are not going to, but they worry that if they don't, then the French will. They keep the Qing Dynasty in power so that it can keep order within the country and keep the silk and the tea produced and bring it to their markets, even as they take more and more territory concessions within all of China's major cities, continually expanding their trading privileges. And it's for 50 years that China endures that. The Qing Dynasty holds on to power for almost 50 years after the Taiping Rebellion, after the point when it seemed like it would fall. It's propped up by regional interests within China and by strategic support from foreign powers, but again, the inexorable process of decline. And by the end of the 19th century, China is known as the sick man of Asia. It is a lumbering land empire carved out by Manchu horseback warriors in the 17th century that somehow limps into the 20th century intact. In any case, the dynasty comes to its end at the hands of Republican revolutionaries in 1912. These are Han Chinese revolutionaries led by Sun Yat-sen and others who want to destroy the Manchus and restore the Chinese to power. They do succeed in overthrowing the Manchus and then immediately reincorporate them into their own country. But the republic never takes root. And just a glimpse forward from this time, the early years of the republic were chaotic. It was an era of warlords, of disunity, of fragmenting centers of control, eras when provinces made war upon each other. Then you have the civil war between Chiang Kai-shek's Kuomintang and the Chinese communists. It begins in the late 1920s and continues off and on until the 1940s. And then the horrors of the Japanese invasion in the 1930s on top of that. All of which means that from the fall of the Qing, China won't really be unified again until the founding of the People's Republic of China in 1949. And even though it was pieced together then, it still hasn't come to a point where it's regained the stature that it held back before the Opium War, back before the Century of Humiliation, back before this long decline. So fast forward to the present. China's current president, Xi Jinping, the centerpiece of his philosophy is this, as he calls it, the Chinese dream, or China's dream. And what is this dream that he talks about? He refers to it as sort of the collective dream of the peoples of China. And when I say peoples, this means not just the Han, but all of the ethnic minorities as well, including the Manchus. The hope of the peoples of China to regain their past glory. And what he means by this is the glory prior to the Opium War. When China was central, when it was powerful, when it inspired awe. And he talks about the Opium War quite a bit in speeches. And he talks about the used to be the 170, now the 175-year struggle of the Chinese people since the Opium War to rebuild themselves again. And as he sees it, the Opium War was the tipping point. That was the moment when a great China was laid low, and everything since then has been a process of rebuilding themselves. As he sees it, the founding of the People's Republic in 1949 was an important step, but it is work that is still underway in today's China. And he imagines that this project will finally be completed around 2050 or so. So the Qianlong era is now seen in sort of glowing terms as what China should be again, that China should put behind it the weaknesses of the 19th century, take back its long-forgotten mantle in Asia. And the memories of that are therefore central to history education in China. The memories of the Opium War and what came afterwards are etched in stone. Any educated person in China has been taught this over and over. The Opium War as a symbol of exploitation by foreigners. The war where foreigners came and forced opium down the throats of the Chinese and the government couldn't do anything about it. There are resonances of the Opium War in nearly all foreign conflicts. In fact, somebody was just telling me that it came up a week ago where in this tiff between China and Canada, where China just arrested a Canadian, or I guess he had already been arrested, but sentenced him to death for drug trafficking. And I haven't seen the report, but apparently the foreign minister in China referenced the Opium War and China's history of being victimized by drug dealers, and therefore we have to take a harsh stand on this. On the other hand, the Taiping Rebellion shows the great dangers of internal disunity. And the funny thing about the Taipings is that Mao Zedong viewed himself as a spiritual descendant of the Taiping leader. And the early communists viewed themselves as essentially finishing the work that the Taipings had begun. They saw the Taipings as a sort of prototype of peasant rebels. who led a peasant revolution to overthrow the landlord class, but failed only because they did not have the proper Marxist-Leninist ideology with which to restructure their country. But in any case, from the 1950s, 60s, through the 70s into the 80s, the Taipings were great heroes in China. And there were monuments to them and books about them. Whoops, there goes my water. There were monuments to them. That's shifted now. And especially since the 1980s, the Taiping are now persona non grata. Why? It's because the Communist Party of China no longer has any revolutionary roots at all. This is not in any respect a revolutionary party. It's a bureaucratic party. And the last thing they want to do is encourage people to model themselves after peasant revolutionaries who are not part of the Communist Party. So today, the Taiping Rebellion is seen as an example of what can happen if you allow centers of belief within the country to run unchecked. Centers of belief that differ from orthodoxy. In the case of the Taipings, it was their nutty Christianity with Hong Xiuquan as the son of God, and that provoked a rebellion that killed 20 to 30 million people. And you can hear the echoes of it in the logic of China's government as it cracks down on religious groups in China, on Christian groups, the current shocking treatment of Muslims in China, these concentration camps that have been set up in Xinjiang, with as many as a million people being locked up and forced to renounce their religion and pledge loyalty to the party and sing patriotic songs, that the fear that comes from behind that is, I would argue, a fear that dates from examining episodes in history like the Taiping Rebellion, that if you do not have unity of ideology, you can have rebellion. And you can have breakdown. So on the one hand, you have the omnipresent memory of past humiliations that is used to drive nationalistic development in China. As the economy rises, as the military rises, they are making up for all the humiliations of the 19th century. On the other hand, there are these more positive views of the great pride that is taken in the earlier past, in Chinese civilization, in Confucianism, in the era before the Opium War. Again, this nostalgic vision of what China could be again. So where does this leave us? The speakers in your conference in February will give their thoughts about where China is headed. I'm not so good about where China is headed because I'm always looking backwards as a historian. But I would say that as China aims to regain this mantle that was lost during the 19th century, I don't think it will be literal. I don't think the Chinese government is going to start asking anyone to kowtow again or anything like that. But it is clear that the country we will be dealing with is not the same weakened and divided nation of the 19th and early 20th centuries that we've always been accustomed to. That in our lifetimes and for generations prior, China was weak and divided, an object of American sympathy or horror, but not awe until now. It will resemble, and its government will want to resemble, that stronger, more central, confident empire in Asia. And so we need to look further into the past than we're accustomed to find possible answers for how to get along or for how to manage the relationship. So as one final note, lest this seem too gloomy of a talk, I would say that from studying the old Canton trade, before the old Canton trade was completely deranged by the rise of opium, like when it was a legal trade, it actually worked quite well. It was a major engine of the global economy. It was a meeting of civilizations that profited both sides. And although the British felt a little humiliated by it, they profited enormously from it, and it was a very productive relationship they had with China at the time. So I guess I would end by saying that as gloomy as things may seem, and the world of Chinese studies in the United States is very gloomy indeed today, I would offer that we can also do far worse than to deal with a strong and confident and unified China. All right, thank you.
Thank you very much. Very enlightening. While we collect some questions from the members here, I usually have my own questions that I'd like to start with because I take the prerogative of the moderator and ask a question first. I wonder if you could comment the post-1949 China. It seems like they've had various stages of development. One was economics first, and then not really interaction with the outside world in the security areas until much more recently. I was in the security area, and they've really engaged more in a lot of things than before. Is that something you would have expected based on their history, the not going out in, you know, into the wider world, but first concentrating on their own economy?
Oh, this question of whether China is an inward-looking nation or one that engages the world. On the long span of China's history, there are periods where China was enormously cosmopolitan and other times when it was very closed. And generally speaking, closure and restriction tends to go along with sort of fragile governments or governments that are fearful and less confident than others. And the restriction of foreign trade had been because of fears of disloyal Chinese subjects collaborating with foreigners to start uprisings or to evade the law and smuggle and do various things like that. And I think today that the more China has engaged with the world, the more confidence there is behind that. Things are tightening now. The government seems more fearful for reasons I don't understand. And I'm not sure who does understand. What exactly is driving things like the crackdowns in Xinjiang, that they are not really prompted by large-scale uprisings. But I am in no way privy to the conversations of the central government in China in the way that as a historian you can go back and look and see what was being said at court in the imperial archives. So I guess that's sort of an evasion of the question, only thing that I don't know, but that in the past, cosmopolitan has gone along with powerful and confident governments in China.
Thank you. Here's one that I find particularly interesting. How does China's trade strategy with Europe today, how is that influenced by the Opium Wars? Are they still remember that? Are they still reluctant to trade with
No,
Europe?
Remarkably, the Opium War lurks whenever you are talking about something like any appearance of China being pushed around. The Opium War resonates loudly with threats of trade war because, as everyone in China knows, China's entrance into the modern world, as they see it, came at the hands of a literal trade war, a shooting war for the sake of trade. Remarkably, the British have been forgiven in ways that the Japanese will never be, apparently, in China. That the wounds of the Second World War are very, very sore in China today. There is enormous lingering anger directed against the Japanese. There is not a similar anger directed at the British for the Opium War. And it was fascinating. I was in Hong Kong about a month or so ago, speaking about the Opium War. And sort of trying to gauge from the people that I talked to there, how had they learned about it? Because Hong Kong is the prize of the Opium War. Britain takes Hong Kong as a colony and is going to govern it all the way up until 1997. And I talked to a woman in Hong Kong who had grown up in Hong Kong when it was a British colony. And she said that she went to an Anglican school, and in her British history class, which was taught by a British person, she learned that the Opium War was basically a good thing. Maybe a little regrettable, but it was about opening trade, and it was about free trade, and look around at how prosperous Hong Kong is, and you can see all the fruits that came from this. And she said at the exact same time, she would go to her Chinese class, which was taught by a Chinese person, where she learned that the Opium War was where the British imperialists came and forced poison down the throats of the Chinese and humiliated them. And she said that she had essentially grown up holding both of these ideas simultaneously, and I think they do exist simultaneously in China. That you know, Hong Kong and Shanghai owe an enormous amount of their prosperity to their colonial and semi-colonial roots, but at the same time, that's also a marker of shame.
People also want to know, and I had several questions related to this here, why weren't the Manchus more pro-trade? Why did they restrict it so much? Wasn't it to their advantage to have greater trade with the outside world?
Essentially, they got what they wanted, which was the silver. And I should say that the Qianlong emperor being so dismissive, we have no use for your country's manufacturers, blah, blah, da, 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 da. Actually, that was posturing. And he himself had a large collection of European clocks that he had put together. He had kept European court painters at his court painting oil portraits of him. He had hired Jesuit missionaries to that palace that was burned down in 1860. These beautiful marble buildings with soaring columns that were built by Europeans. So he patronized Europeans at court. The silver that was coming into China through Canton was enormously important. At a time of rising population, it helped to stabilize the economy. A large amount of it went for paying the imperial household's expenses. So Chenlong knew how important trade was. It wasn't that trade was unimportant. It was just that he felt that they were getting everything that they needed through Canton. And by focusing it at one port, that meant that you could focus the government, which was very far away from Beijing, you could keep it at a distance. You could keep it in the hands of reliable people that you were that you trusted. There was a small monopoly of Chinese merchants who were about 12 of them who were the only ones allowed to trade with the foreigners. And in other words, you can manage it so that you can get all the profits from it without worrying about all of the collaborations and conspirings that can happen with when you have a Chinese population that you really don't trust, working with foreigners that you equally do not trust who have shared interests. And this, incidentally, was part of the logic of the Opium War itself. Opponents of the war in Britain pointed out early on that this is the most absurd way of going about undertaking a war, that to imagine that you could send a small fleet and a few thousand soldiers to make war on the largest empire in existence, on an empire of 300 or 400 million people, how could this possibly work out well for the British? And the proponents of the war, what they argued, and sort of here echoes of Iraq here, they said, actually, the Chinese merchants of China all want contact with the British. And if we go in offering free trade, the merchants are all going to come over to our side because it's only this jealous government of the Manchus in Beijing that tries to restrict trade. And sadly, that turned out to be true enough that even in the midst of the war, the British had no problem being supplied by merchants along the coast of China who were selling them supplies even as they were making war against the government. So for the Manchus, it was they were proven right in the end, for I guess you could say, which is that since they essentially did not trust their own population, they tried to keep the trade centered so that foreign contact would be also very carefully controlled.
But you may have answered this in a way, but let me ask it more directly. Tea seems to have been a major industry. Didn't that extend to a middle class or create the middle class, or was it so controlled that only the 12 merchants that...
Oh, no, no, no. Oh, you mean the actual production of tea? The actual production of tea was enormous. I mean, all of the tea for China and then all of the tea for export. One of the things that was so profitable for Canton and so arbitrary about it is that the tea was being grown way up in central China along the Yangtze River. And it all had to be shipped and carried by hand over mountain passes and shipped on long canals to get it to Canton to be sold. And all of those middlemen and all of the tea packers and the peasants who pulled boats along the water. Prior to the Opium War, there are some fascinating debates amongst Chinese scholars about the value of foreign trade and whether it's a good thing for China or a bad thing for China. And as one of them points out, there are sort of hardline nationalists in the 1820s and 30s in China who say, well, we don't need any of that garbage from abroad anyway, and we should just shut down the whole foreign trade and tell them to go home. And then there are others who argue that actually if we did that, then tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of people in China would lose their livelihood. And that there were so many people in South China who were involved in some way with the foreign trade that even though the point of contact is just those 12 merchant families and the monopoly of the East India Company up until 1834, behind that you have a huge economy for producing all of this tea. So the foreign trade was always important for China. And it's sort of, it's the posturing of the Chenlong Emperor saying, we have no need of your trade, that gets sort of instilled in the British and American imagination as being, oh, the Chinese don't want trade. Oh, they very much did. Yeah. One other thing that I would add to that, though, is that traditionally in China, Confucian scholars have looked down on merchants. There were periods in China's history where children of merchants weren't even allowed to take the civil service examinations. And as they see it, you know, that scholars are the ones filled with the virtues of Confucianism, whereas these mere merchants are just mucking around with money and getting rich, and they have no virtue whatsoever. This is a sort of a central agon in Chinese history, between sort of the moralists and the commercial ones. But China has always had an extremely strong commercial tradition. And I'd say that relations with the West worked best when relations were in the hands of merchants on both sides.
Might be true today, too.
Yeah.
You focused mainly on trade and China's victimization. What about international affairs and military concerns at that point, during the 19th century?
I'm trying to think whether China had any significant military concerns beyond its own borders. I mean, up until the 20th century, I mean, aside from border wars, and Qing China's military attention was largely devoted to Central Asia, which is where the big wars were fought in the Qing dynasty, and where the bulk of the military spending went. China was not trying to establish any kind of an overseas empire, it didn't have those same sort of outward connections that, you know, say the British or the Americans did. And furthermore, the raw fact of the Canton trade, that the merchants of China sort of sat fixed in one place while the merchants from the West came sailing around the world in order to get to Canton, led to a certain complacency in that sense as well, I would say.
Thank you. Here's one. Does today's globalization mean that historical context has less impact than in previous generations? Does historical impact from national perspective. Does a country's history have less impact today than it had early 20th century? Does their history have as much impact on what they do today as it did previously?
The history is still just as central to education. And I think there's a reticence with regard to globalism. Sort of a sense of what will China get from it? What does China stand to gain from concessions to international bodies? I mean, what we've seen since the 1980s and 90s especially, China was very much willing to adapt itself in order to present itself as a fair player in world organizations. These days, while they are still obviously central to the UN and other organizations, there seems to be a little more impatience. At the same time, if you took somebody from the 19th century and plunked them down in the world today, they would be absolutely baffled by what roles have changed. Specifically, the fact that today China, which was bashed open to free trade by the British in the Opium War, now China is getting to present itself as the world's leader of free trade, even as the U.S. president dreams of protectionism and tariffs. Similarly, the drug problem has reversed as well. It's America that now has its opioid problem, and there are arguments from Congress that much of the fentanyl is coming from China, and they need to do something about it. So history, as they say, doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes. And in the case of the 19th century, what's less important than direct parallels, which always sort of fall apart when you look up close, is the more emotional responses. And especially expectations of the population. Xi Jinping is not elected by the Chinese people, but he is beholden to public opinion in the sense that there is a large nationalistic population in China that expects him to stand up if China seems to be pushed around on trade. And that is due to the memories of the Opium War and the century of humiliation that they've been instilled with. So it's more of the sort of the emotional response that it crafts, and then leaders need to respond to and manage that.
Yeah. Thank you. How do you think China's history informs the current trade disputes and how that might end? Is there a lesson from Chinese history and what we can expect from the Chinese?
I basically already said it. I think the lesson is to let trade interests lead the way in the relationship. The thing that I find so alarming about the prospect of trade war with China, and hopefully it's going to sort of fade away and be forgotten, is that, I mean, going all the way back, when there was a strong engagement on trade, that provided a ballast for the relationship. In the 18th and 19th centuries, generally problems cropped up in the 19th century once you introduce non-commercial interests, once you introduce diplomats, people with ideas of state honor and prestige, driving them, military figures and things like that. When Canton was left to the merchants, it generally righted itself from any crises that happened there. The wars erupted because of outsiders who got involved. And I would say in the more recent history of China and the United States that, again, trade really is the ballast for the relationship. And if we have strong engagement on trade, that gives a platform for us to engage on issues that are much more tense, things like military issues, human rights issues, some things more positive, cultural exchange, students going back and forth. But all of these other aspects of our relationship are sort of founded on the fundamental fact that we need each other for our economies, that we need each other for trade. And if that goes out the window, then I don't know what happens to engagement on the other issues.
And here's one, it's a little different line of thinking. Are there explanations in Chinese history for the discipline and patriotism of Chinese people, including their expertise in math and science?
Wait, say that again?
Including their expertise in math and science.
But what was the first?
Are there explanations in Chinese history for why we view the Chinese people as very disciplined and very patriotic?
I shy away from trying to explain anything sort of broadly cultural like that. I mean, when you come right down to it, China is a place with 1.3 billion people, each of whom has a very different opinion about things. But I would say that the educational system there is intensely competitive. There is a large population. There are a small number of plum spots that can be gotten. And in recent education, in sort of post-cultural revolution education, once the universities were reopened in the 1980s, you had incredibly tough competition to get spots in universities. When my first experience in China was as a teacher at a middle school in central China in Hunan province. And spending 2 years seeing the lives of my students there and everything that hung on them, all of their families' hopes for them, especially in a one-child era, that they were the single hope for their family to go forward, and the incredible stress put on them to get through that naturally results in the end with successful students who have done really well on exams. It's almost a teleology. But there are echoes in that from the past, the civil service exams, that the only path to becoming gaining widespread prestige in China and power is to be a part of the government somehow. And the only way you can do that is to take an examination, which the lower level ones at the district level were once a year, but at the provincial and national level is once every 3 years. If you could compete in that and if you could pass it, then you could become an official. And there would be prestige for your family, or there would be power. But in terms of the ladder of success, there were three levels of the exam. The bottom level, at the district level, this is to qualify for it, you already have to have spent probably 10 or 15 years of your life memorizing the Confucian classics. You have a test with rote memorization. You had to be able to finish off quotes and say what character came after what. Only 1 in 100 would pass that exam. Of those who passed it, they could go and take the provincial examination at the provincial capital, given once every 3 years, and again, only 1 out of 100 would pass that. By the time you get to the end, passing the top level examination, if you pass that, you represent 1 out of 30,000. And what I tell my students, just to sort of bring this home, an American high school varsity basketball player has a 3 times better chance of making the NBA than one of these young exam candidates in China ever did. Hong Xiuquan, the leader of the Taiping rebels who had the epiphany that he was the son of God, this came from a breakdown occasioned from having failed his civil service examination too many times. And the wonderful irony that here is a young man who actually had devoted his life to trying to be a civil servant and serve the Qing dynasty. And when he was thwarted and had his breakdown and his epiphany and raised a rebellion, it's sort of the rage of a failed exam candidate writ large. So I think surely as a method of managing the selection for merit within a huge population, there are aspects of that carry on today. But it's changing. And there are constant arguments in China about, they talk about sort of a quality of the population, that we need to do more to incorporate sort of arts and creativity and things like that, and that's what will make us strong. Even as, you know, in Massachusetts, we have the MCAS test, and a lot of American school districts are looking to China and Singapore and saying we need more standardization. I think it's probably the balance lies somewhere in the middle.
So as a final question, and this one is very broad, pundits insist that China is a greater danger to the U.S. than Russia. Do you think that we should be worried about China?
Pundits insist. Oh, you keep asking me these contemporary questions. These are questions for your Camden conference, people. I can tell you about the Qing dynasty. Why do they think China is a greater danger than Russia? Because it has its act together better. I'm not a cybersecurity expert by any means. I can only sort of divine what the pundits may be saying. But there is a perception of efficiency to Chinese cyber espionage. There is the power of their economy. There is sort of the unity of the country, and in contrast to the mucking about with elections that the Russians have done, which they've always done. I mean, they were doing that in the 1970s as well, and they seem to have gotten quite lucky in 2016. But I don't know. I can't really answer that question properly. Russia's territorial threats to Eastern Europe are far scarier than some of the threats in Asia. But then you look at the South China Sea and China's expansion there, and how do you balance one against the other, sort of the threat to NATO versus the threat to Southeast Asia from China's naval expansion in the South China Sea? So I guess in the end, I'll take a pass on that question.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And we can't let you leave without giving you the coveted Mid-Coast Forum cup.
Ooh, thank you.
So that you'll be able to drink your coffee or morning tea, out of something to remind you of us.
Oh, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I did. Let me get